"She has most graciously agreed to speak today," he told me, rocking back a little on his boot heels. "Where would be the best place, do you think, Mum? From the terrace, as being the point of highest elevation? Or perhaps near the statue on the lawn, as being more central, and allowing the crowd to surround her, thus increasing the chance of everyone hearing her remarks?"
"I think she'll have a sunstroke if you put her out on the lawn in this weather," I said, tilting my own broad-brimmed straw hat to shade my nose. It was easily in the 90s, in terms both of temperature and humidity, and my thin petticoats clung soddenly to my lower limbs. "What sort of remarks is she going to make?"
"Just a brief address upon the subject of loyalty, Mum," he said blandly. "Ah, there is your husband talking to Kingsborough. If you'll excuse me, Mum."
Bowing, he straightened, put his hat back on, and strode down the lawn to join Jamie and Jocasta, who were still with Alan MacDonald, styled Kingsborough in the Scottish fashion, for the name of his estate on Skye. Food was beginning to be brought out, tureens of pau saudi and hotchpotch, and an enormous tub of soup à la reine, a clear compliment to the guest of honour. Platters of fried fish, fried chicken, fried rabbit, venison collops in red wine, smoked sausages, four for bridies, inky pinky, roast turkeys, pigeon pie, dishes of col canon, stovies, turnip puree, roast apples stuffed with dried pumpkin, squash, corn, mushroom pasties, gigantic baskets overflowing with fresh baps, rolls, and other breads. All this, I was well aware, merely as a prelude to the barbecue, whose succulent aroma was drifting through the air. A number of hogs, three or four beeves, two deer, and the pièce de résistance, a wood bison, acquired God knew how or where. A hum of pleasant anticipation rose around me as people began metaphorically to loosen their belts, squaring up to the tables with a firm determination to do their duty in honour of the occasion. Jamie was still stuck fast to Mrs. MacDonald, I saw. He was helping her to a dish of what looked from the distance to be broccoli salad. He looked up and saw me, beckoned me to join them. But I shook my head, gesturing with my fan toward the buffet tables, where the guests were setting to in the businesslike manner of grasshoppers in a barley field. I didn't want to lose the opportunity of inquiring about Manfred MacGillivray before the stupor of satiety settled over the crowd. I made my way purposefully into the fray, accepting tidbits offered to me by assorted servants and slaves, pausing to chat with any acquaintance I saw, particularly those from Hillsborough. Manfred had spent a great deal of time there, I knew, taking commissions for guns, delivering the finished products, and doing small jobs of repair. That was the most likely place for him to go, I thought, but no one I talked to had seen him, though most knew him.
"Nice lad," one gentleman told me, pausing momentarily in his potations, "and sore missed too. Besides Robin, there's few gunsmiths closer than Virginia."
I knew that, and knowing, wondered whether Jamie was having any luck in locating the muskets he needed. Perhaps Lord John's smuggling connections would be necessary. I accepted a small pie from a passing slave's tray, and wandered on, munching and chatting. There was much talk about a series of fiery articles that had appeared recently in the Chronicle, the local newspaper, whose proprietor, one Fogarty Sims, was spoken of with considerable sympathy.
"A rare plucked on his Sims," said Mr. Goodwin, shaking his head. "But I doubt me he'll stand. I spoke with him last week, and he told me he's in some fear of his skin. There's been threats, eh?"
From the tone of the gathering, I assumed that Mr. Sims must be a loyalist, and this appeared to be true from the various accounts I was given. There was talk, apparently, of a rival paper setting up, this to support the Whiggish agenda, with its incautious talk of tyranny and the overthrow of the king. No one knew quite who was behind the new venture, but there was talk, and much indignation at the prospect, that a printer was to be brought down from the north, where folk were notably given to such perverse sentiments. The general consensus was that such persons wanted their backsides kicked to bring them to their senses. I hadn't sat down to eat formally, but after an hour of moving slowly through fields of champing jaws and wandering herds of hors d'oeuvre trays, I felt as though I'd sat through a French royal banquet, those occasions lasting so long that chamber pots were discreetly placed beneath the guests' chairs, and where the occasional guest giving way and sliding beneath the table was discreetly ignored. The present occasion was less formal, but not much less prolonged. After an hour's preliminary eating, the barbecue was raised steaming from the pits near the stable and brought to the lawns on wooden trestles mounted on the shoulders of slaves. The sight of immense sides of beef, pork, venison, and buffalo, gleaming with oil and vinegar, and surrounded by the smaller, charred carcasses of hundreds of pigeons and quail, was greeted with applause by the guests, all by this time drenched with the sweat of their efforts, but nothing daunted. Jocasta, seated by her guest, looked deeply gratified by the sound of her hospitality being so warmly accepted, and leaned toward Duncan, smiling, putting a hand on his arm as she said something to him. Duncan had left off looking nervous, the effect of a quart or two of beer, followed by most of a bottle of whiskey, and seemed to be enjoying himself too. He smiled broadly at Jocasta, then essayed a remark to Mrs. MacDonald, who laughed at whatever he said. I had to admire her. She was besieged on all sides by people wanting a word, but she kept her poise admirably, being kind and gracious to everyone, though this meant sitting sometimes for 10 minutes, a forkful of food suspended in air as she listened to some interminable story. At least she was in the shade, and Phèdre, dressed in white muslin, stood dutifully behind her with a huge fan made of palmetto fronds, making a breeze and keeping off the flies.
"Lemon shrub, ma'am."
A wilting slave, gleaming with sweat, offered me yet another tray, and I took a glass. I was dripping with perspiration, my legs aching and my throat dried with talking. At this point I didn't care what was in the glass, provided it was wet. I changed my opinion instantly upon tasting it. It was lemon juice and barley water, and while it was wet, I was much more inclined to pour it down the neck of my gown than to drink it. I edged unobtrusively toward a laburnum bush, intending to pour the drink into it, but was forestalled by the appearance of Neil Forbes, who stepped out from behind it. He was as startled to see me as I was to see him. He jerked back and glanced hastily over his shoulder. I looked in the same direction and caught sight of Robert Howe and Cornelius Harnett making off in the opposite direction. Clearly the three of them had been conferring secretly behind the laburnum bush.
"Mrs. Fraser," he said, with a short bow. "Your servant."
I curtsied in return with a vague murmur of politeness. I would have slithered past him, but he leaned toward me, preventing my exit.
"I hear that your husband is collecting guns, Mrs. Fraser," he said,
his voice at a low and rather unfriendly pitch. "Oh, really?" I was holding an open fan, as was every other woman there. I waved it languidly before my nose, hiding most of my expression. "Who told you such a thing?"
"One of the gentlemen whom he approached to that end," Forbes said. The lawyer was large and somewhat overweight. The unhealthy shade of red in his cheeks might be due to that, rather than to displeasure. Then again,
"If I might impose so far upon your good nature, ma'am, I would suggest that you exert your influence upon him so as to suggest that such a course is not the wisest."
"To begin with," I said, taking a deep breath of hot, damp air, "just what course do you think he's embarked upon?"
"An unfortunate one, ma'am," he said. "Putting the best complexion upon the matter, I assume that the guns he seeks are intended to arm his own company of militia, which is legitimate, though disturbing. The desirability of that course would rest upon his later actions. But his relations with the Cherokee are well known, and there are rumours about that the weapons are destined to end in the hands of the savages, to the end that they may turn upon His Majesty's subjects, who presumed to offer objection to the tyranny, abuse and corruption so rife among the officials who govern, if so loose a word may be employed to describe their actions, this colony.
I gave him a long look over the edge of my fan. "If I hadn't already known you were a lawyer," I remarked, "that speech would have done it. I think that you just said that you suspect my husband of wanting to give guns to the Indians, and you don't like that. On the other hand, if he's wanting to arm his own militia, that might be all right, providing that said militia acts according to your desires. Am I right?"
A flicker of amusement showed in his deep-set eyes, and he inclined his head toward me in acknowledgement.
"Your perception astounds me, ma'am," he said.
I nodded and shut the fan. "Right. And what are your desires, may I ask? I won't ask why you think Jamie ought to take heed of them."
He laughed, his heavy face already flushed with the heat, going a deeper shade of red beneath his neat tie wig.
"I desire justice, ma'am, the downfall of tyrants and the cause of liberty," he said, "as must any honest man."
"Freedom alone, which any honest man surrenders only with his life." The line echoed in my head and must have shown on my face, for he looked keenly at me.
"I esteem your husband deeply, ma'am," he said quietly. "You will tell him what I have said."
He bowed and turned away, not waiting for my nod. He hadn't guarded his voice when speaking of tyrants and liberty. I saw heads nearby turn, and here and there men drew together, murmuring as they watched him go. Distracted, I took a mouthful of lemon shrub and was then obliged to swallow the nasty stuff. I turned to find Jamie. He was still near Alan MacDonald, but had moved a little aside and was in private conversation with Major MacDonald. Things were moving faster than I had thought. I had thought Republican sentiment was still a minority in this part of the colony, but for Forbes to speak so openly in a public gathering, it was obviously gaining ground. I turned back to look after the lawyer and saw two men confront him, their faces tight with anger and suspicion. I was too far away to hear what was said, but their postures and expressions were eloquent. Words were exchanged, growing in heat, and I glanced toward Jamie. The last time I had attended a barbecue like this at River Run, in the prelude to the War of the Regulation, there had been a fistfight on the lawn, and I rather thought such an occurrence might be about to happen again. Alcohol, heat, and politics made for explosions of temper in any gathering, let alone one composed largely of Highlanders. Such an explosion might have happened. More men were gathering round Forbes and his two opponents, fists curling in readiness. Had the boom of Jocasta's large gong not sounded from the terrace, making everyone look up in startlement. The Major was standing on an upturned tobacco hogshead, hands raised in the air, beaming at the multitudes, face shining with heat, beer, and enthusiasm.
"Cade me la forcha," he called,
and was greeted by enthusiastic applause.
"And we wish 100,000 welcomes to our honoured guests," he continued in Gaelic, sweeping a hand toward the MacDonalds, who were now standing side by side near him, nodding and smiling at the applause. From their demeanour, I rather thought they were accustomed to this sort of reception. A few more introductory remarks, half drowned in the enthusiastic cheers, and Jamie and Kingsborough lifted Mrs. MacDonald carefully up onto the barrel, where she swayed a little, but regained her balance, grabbing the heads of both men for stability, and smiling at the laughter of the audience. She beamed at the crowd, who beamed back en masse, and immediately quieted themselves in order to hear her. She had a clear, high voice, and was obviously accustomed to speaking in public, a most unusual attribute in a woman of the time. I was too far away to hear every word, but had no trouble picking up the gist of her speech. After graciously thanking her hosts, the Scottish community who had welcomed her family so warmly and generously, and the guests, she commenced an earnest exhortation against what she called factionalism,
urging her hearers to join in suppressing this dangerous movement, which could not but cause great unrest, threatening the peace and prosperity that so many of them had achieved in this fair land, they having risked everything to attain it. And she was, I realized with a small shock, exactly right. I'd heard Bree and Roger arguing the point, why any of the Highlanders, who had suffered so much under English rule, should have fought on the English side, as many of them eventually would. Because, Roger had said patiently, they had something to lose, and damn little to gain. And, of all people, they knew exactly what it was like to fight against the English. You think folk who lived through Cumberland's cleansing of the Highlands made it to America and rebuilt their lives from nothing were eager to live through all that again? But surely they'll want to fight for freedom, Bree had protested. He looked at her cynically. They have freedom, a great deal more than they've ever seen in Scotland. They risk losing it in the event of a war, and they knew that very well.
And then, of course, he'd added, nearly all of them have sworn an oath of loyalty to the Crown. They'd not break it lightly, surely not for something that looked like one more wild-eyed and doubtless short-lived political upheaval. It's like...
His brow had furrowed as he looked for a suitable analogy. Like the Black Panthers or the Civil Rights Movement. Anyone could see the idealistic point, but a lot of middle-class people found the whole thing threatening or frightening and just wished it would go away so life could be peaceful. The trouble, of course, was that life never was peaceful, and this particular wild-eyed movement wasn't going to go away. I could see Brianna on the far side of the crowd, eyes narrowed in thoughtful speculation as she listened to Flora MacDonald's high, clear voice, talking of the virtues of loyalty. I heard a low sort of mmm just to the side behind me, and turning, saw Neil Forbes, his heavy features set in disapproval. He had reinforcements now, I saw. Three or four other gentlemen stood close beside him, glancing to and fro, but trying not to look as though they were. Gauging the mood of the crowd, I thought they were outnumbered by roughly 200 to 1. And the 200 were growing steadily more entrenched in their opinions as the drink took hold and the speech went on. Looking away, I caught sight again of Brianna and realized that she was now looking at Neil Forbes too. And he was looking back. Both taller than the people around them, they stared at each other over the heads of the intervening crowd. He with animosity, she with aloofness. She had rejected his suit a few years before and had done so without tact. Forbes certainly hadn't been in love with her, but he was a man with a fair degree of self-esteem and not the sort to suffer such a public slight with philosophical resignation. Brianna turned away, coolly, as though she had taken no notice of him, and spoke to the woman beside her. I heard him grunt again, say something in a low tone to his compatriots, and then the knot of them were leaving, rudely turning their backs on Mrs. MacDonald, who was still speaking. Gasps and murmurs of indignation followed them as they shoved their way through the thick-packed crowd, but no one offered to stop them, and the offence of their leaving was drowned by the outburst of prolonged applause that greeted the conclusion of the speech, this accompanied by the starting up of bagpipes, the random firing of pistols into the air, organised cheering of "Hip, hip, huzzay!" led by Major MacDonald, and such a general hullabaloo that no one would have noticed the arrival of an army, let alone the departure of a few disaffected Whigs. I found Jamie in the shade of Hector's mausoleum, combing out his hair with his fingers, preparatory to retying it. "That went with a bang, didn't it?" I asked.
"Several of them," he said,
keeping a wary eye on one obviously inebriated gentleman in the act of trying to reload his musket.
"Watch that man, Sassenach."
"He's too late to shoot, Neil Forbes. Did you see him leave?" He nodded, deftly knotting the leather thong at his nape.
"He couldn't have come much closer to an open declaration, save he'd got up on the barrel next to Funachal."
"And that would have made him an excellent target," I squinted at the red-faced gentleman presently spilling gunpowder on his shoes. I don't think he has any bullets.
Oh, well, then.
Jamie dismissed him with a wave of the hand.
Major MacDonald's in rare form, no?
He told me he's arranged for Mrs. MacDonald to give such speeches here and there about the colony.
With himself as impresario, I take it. I could just catch the gleam of MacDonald's red coat among the press of well-wishers on the terrace.
I dare say.
Jamie didn't seem pleased at the prospect. In fact, he seemed rather sober, his face shadowed by dark thoughts. His mood wouldn't be improved by hearing about my conversation with Neil Forbes. But I told him anyway.
Well, it couldn't be helped, he said, with a small shrug. I'd hoped to keep the matter quiet, but with things as they are, we're Robin MacGillivray. I've no real choice save to ask where I may, though that lets the matter be known and talked about.
He moved again, restless.
Are you well, Sassenach?
He asked suddenly, looking at me. Yes.
But you aren't.
What is it? He smiled faintly.
Och, that's nothing. Nothing I didn't ken already. But it's different, no? You think you're ready, and then you meet it face to face and would give anything to have it otherwise.
He looked out at the lawn, lifting his chin to point at the crowd. A sea of tartan flowed across the grass, the ladies' parasols raised against the sun, a field of brightly coloured flowers. In the shade of the terrace, a piper played on, the sound of his pibroch, a thin, piercing descant to the hum of conversation.
I kent I should have to stand one day against a good many of them, to fight friends and kin. But then I found myself standing there, with Fionnachal's hand upon my head like a blessing, face to face with them all, and watching her words fall upon them, see the resolve growing in them, and all of a sudden it was as though a great blade had come down from heaven between them and me, to cleave us forever apart. The day is coming, and I cannot stop it.
He swallowed and looked down, away from me. I reached out to him, wanting to help, wanting to ease him, and knowing that I couldn't. It was, after all, by my doing that he found himself here, in this small Gethsemane. Nonetheless, he took my hand, not looking at me, and squeezed it hard, so the bones pressed together. "Lord, that this cup might pass from me," I whispered. He nodded, his gaze still resting on the ground, the fallen petals of the yellow roses. Then he looked at me, with a small smile, but with such pain in his eyes that I caught my breath, stricken to the heart. "Still," he smiled, and wiping his hand across his forehead, examined his wet fingers.
"Aye, well," he said. "It's only water, not blood. I'll live."
"Perhaps you won't," I thought suddenly, appalled. To fight on the winning side was one thing, to survive, quite another. He saw the look on my face and released the pressure on my hand, thinking he was hurting me. He was, but not physically.
"But not my will be done, but thine,"
he said, very softly.
"I chose my way when I wed you, though I kent it not at the time. But I chose, and cannot now turn back, even if I would."
"Would you?" I looked into his eyes as I asked, and read the answer there. He shook his head.
"Would you? For you have chosen, as much as I."
I shook my head as well, and felt the small relaxation of his body as his eyes met mine, clear now as the brilliant sky. For the space of a heartbeat we stood alone together in the universe. Then a knot of chattering girls drifted within earshot, and I changed the subject to something safer. "Have you heard anything about poor Manfred?"
"Poor Manfred, is it?"
He gave me a cynical look.
"Well, he may be an immoral young hound and have caused any amount of trouble, but that doesn't mean he ought to die for it."
He looked as though he might not be in complete agreement with his sentiment, but let the matter lie, saying merely that he'd asked, but so far without result.
"He'll turn up, though," he assured me, likely in the most inconvenient place.
Oh, 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 that I should live to see such a day. I thank you, sir. Thank you indeed.
It was Mrs. Bug, flushed with heat, beer, and happiness, fanning herself fit to bust. Jamie smiled at her.
So we are able to hear everything then, Mukhriya?
Oh, indeed I was, sir, she assured him fervently. Every word. Arch found me a lovely place, just by one of the tubs of wee flowers, where I could hear and not be trampled.
She had nearly died of excitement when Jamie had offered to bring her down to the barbecue.
Arch was coming, of course, and would go on to do errands in Cross Creek, but Mrs. Bug hadn't been off the ridge since their arrival several years before.
Despite my disquiet over the profoundly loyalist atmosphere that surrounded us, her bubbling delight was infectious, and I found myself smiling, Jamie and myself taking it in turns to answer her questions. She hadn't seen black slaves close to before, and thought them exotically beautiful. Did they cost a great deal? And must they be taught to wear clothes and speak properly? For she had heard that Africa was a heathen place where folk went entirely naked and killed one another with spears, like as one would do with a boar. And if one wanted to speak of naked, that statue of the soldier laddie on the lawn was shocking, did we not think? And him, we not a stitch behind his shield? And why ever was that woman's heed at his feet? And had I looked, her hair was made to look as if it were snakes of all horrid things. And who was Hector Cameron, whose tomb this was, and made all of white marble, same as the tombs in Holyrood? Imagine! Oh, Mrs. Innes's late husband. And when had she married Mr. Duncan, whom she had met? And such a sweet, kind-eyed man as he was, such a shame as he had lost his arm. Was that in a battle of some type? And oh, look, Mrs. MacDonald's husband, and a fine figure of a man he was too, was going to talk as well.
Jamie gave the terrace a bleak look. Sure enough, Alan MacDonald was stepping up, merely onto a stool. No doubt the hogshead seemed extreme. And a number of people, far fewer than had attended his wife, but a respectable number, were clustering round attentively.
Will you no come and hear him?
Mrs. Bug was already in flight, hovering above the ground like a hummingbird.
I'll hear well enough from here, Jamie assured her. You go along then, Anian.
She bumbled off, buzzing with excitement. Jamie gingerly touched both hands to his ears, testing to be sure they were still attached.
It was kind of you to bring her, I said, laughing. The dear old thing probably hasn't had such fun in half a century.
No, he said, grinning. She likely...
He stopped abruptly, frowning as he caught sight of something over my shoulder. I turned to look, but he was already moving past me, and I hurried to catch up. It was Jocasta, white as milk, and dishevelled in a way I had never seen her. She swayed unsteadily in the side doorway and might have fallen had Jamie not come up and taken quick hold of her, one arm about her waist, to support her.
"Jesus, Auntie, what's amiss?"
He spoke quietly, not to draw attention, and was moving her back inside the house even as he spoke.
"Oh, God! Oh, merciful God! My head!" she whispered,
hands spread over her face like a spider, so that her fingers barely touched the skin, cupping her left eye.
"My eye!"
The linen blindfold that she wore in public was creased and blotched with moisture. Tears were leaking out from under it, but she wasn't crying. Lacrimation. One eye was watering terribly. Both eyes were tearing, but much worse on the left. The edge of the linen was soaked, and wetness shone on that cheek. "I need to look at her eye," I said to Jamie, touching his elbow, and looking round in vain for any of the servants. "Get her to her sitting room." That was closest, and all the guests were either outside or traipsing through the parlour to see the prince's looking-glass.
"No!"
It was almost a scream.
"No! Not there!"
Jamie glanced at me, one brow raised in puzzlement, but spoke soothingly to her.
"Nay, Auntie, it's all right. I'll bring you to your own chamber. Come, then."
He stooped and lifted her in his arms as though she were a child, her silk skirts falling over his arm with the sound of rushing water.
"Take her. I'll be right there."
I'd spotted the slave named Angelina passing through the far end of the hall and hurried to catch her up. I gave my orders, then rushed back toward the stairs, pausing momentarily to glance into the small sitting room as I did so. There was no one there, though the presence of scattered punch cups and the strong scent of pipe tobacco indicated that Jocasta had likely been holding court there earlier. Her work basket stood open, some half-knitted garment dragged out and left to dangle carelessly down the side like a dead rabbit. Children, perhaps, I thought. Several balls of thread had been pulled out too and lay scattered on the parquet floor trailing their colours. I hesitated, but instinct was too much for me, and I hastily scooped up the balls of thread and dropped them back into the workbasket. I stuffed the knitting in on top, but jerked my hand back with an exclamation. A small gash on the side of my thumb was welling blood. I put it in my mouth and sucked hard to apply pressure to the wound. Meanwhile, I groped more cautiously in the depths of the basket with my other hand to see what had cut me. A knife, small but businesslike, likely used to cut embroidery threads. There was a tooled leather sheath for it, loose in the bottom of the basket. I slipped the knife back into its sheath, seized the needle case I'd come for, and closed the folding tabletop of the workbasket before hurrying for the stairs. Alan MacDonald had finished his brief speech. There was a loud clatter of applause outside, with shouts and whoops of Gaelic approval. "Bloody Scots," I muttered under my breath. "Don't they ever learn?" But I hadn't time to consider the implications of the MacDonald's rabble-rousing. By the time I reached the top of the stair, one slave was close behind me, puffing under the weight of my medicine box, and another was at the bottom, starting more cautiously up with a pan of hot water from the kitchen. Jocasta was bent double in her big chair, moaning, lips pressed into invisibility. Her cap had come off, and both hands moved restlessly to and fro through her disordered hair, as though looking helplessly for something to seize. Jamie was stroking her back, murmuring to her in Gaelic. He looked up with obvious relief as I came in. I had long suspected that the cause of Jocasta's blindness was glaucoma, rising pressure inside the eyeball that, if untreated, eventually damages the optic nerve. Now I was quite sure of it. More than that, I knew what form of the disease she had. She was plainly having an acute attack of closed-angle glaucoma, the most dangerous type. There was no treatment for glaucoma now. The condition itself wouldn't be recognized for some time. Even if there had been, it was far too late. Her blindness was permanent. There was, however, something I could do about the immediate situation, and I was afraid I'd have to. "Put some of this to steep," I said to Angelina, grabbing the jar of golden seal from my box and thrusting it into her hands. "And you?" I turned to the other slave, a man whose name I didn't know. "Set the water to boil again. Fetch me some clean rags and put them in the water." Even as I talked, I'd got out the tiny spirit lamp I carried in my case. The fire had been allowed to burn down on the hearth, but there were still live coals. I bent and lit the wick, then opened the needle case I'd taken from the sitting room and abstracted the largest needle in it, a 3-inch length of steel used for mending carpets. "You aren't," Jamie began, then broke off, swallowing. "I have to," I said briefly. "There's nothing else. Hold her hands." He was nearly as pale as Jocasta, but he nodded and took hold of the clutching fingers, pulling her hands gently away from her head. I lifted away the linen bandage. The left eye bulged noticeably beneath its lid, vividly bloodshot. Tears welled up round it and overflowed in a constant stream. I could feel the pressure inside the eyeball, even without touching it, and clenched my teeth in revulsion. "No help for it?" With a quick prayer to St. Clair, who was, after all, patroness of sore eyes, as well as my own patron saint, I ran the needle through the flame of the lamp, poured pure alcohol onto a rag, and wiped the soot from the needle. Swallowing a sudden excess of saliva, I spread the eyelids of the affected eye apart with one hand, commended my soul to God, and shoved the needle hard into the sclera of the eye, near the edge of the iris. There was a cough and a splattering on the floor nearby and the stink of vomit, but I had no attention to spare. I withdrew the needle carefully, though as fast as I could. Jocasta had stiffened abruptly, frozen stiff, hands clawed over Jamie's. She didn't move at all, but made small, shocked panting sounds, as though afraid to move enough even to breathe. There was a trickle of fluid from the eye, vitreous humour, faintly cloudy, just thick enough to be distinguishable as it flowed sluggishly across the wet surface of the sclera. I was still holding the eyelids apart. I plucked a rag from the golden seal tea with my free hand, squeezed out the excess liquid, careless of where it went, and touched it gently to her face. Jocasta gasped at the touch of the warmth on her skin, pulled her hands free, and grasped at it. I let go then, and allowed her to seize the warm rag, pressing it against her closed left eye, the heat of it some relief. Light feet pounded up the stairs again and down the hall. Angelina, panting, a handful of salt clutched to her bosom, a spoon in her other hand. I brushed the salt from her damp palm into the pan of warm water and set her to stir it while it dissolved. "Did you bring laudanum?" I asked her quietly. Jocasta was lying back in her chair, eyes closed, but rigid as a statue, her eyelids squeezed tight, fists clenched in knots on her knees.
"Couldn't find the laudanum, missus,"
Angelina murmured to me with a frightened glance at Jocasta.
"I dinna ken who could be taking it. Ain't nobody got the key but Mr. Ulysses and Miss Cameron herself."
"Ulysses let you into the Simples closet, then? So he knows that Mrs. Cameron is ill." She nodded vigorously, setting the ribbon on her cap a flutter.
"Oh, yes, missus. He'd be bleezing if he find out and I ain't told him. He say come fetch him quick. She want him. Otherwise, I tell Miss Cameron she ain't to worry none. He take care every single thing."
Jocasta let out a long sigh at this, her clenched fists relaxing a little.
"God bless the man," she murmured, eyes closed. "He will take care of everything. I should be lost without him. Lost."
Her white hair was soaked at the temples, and sweat dripped from the ends of the tendrils that lay over her shoulder, making spots on the dark blue silk of her gown. Angelina unlaced Jocasta's gown and stays, and got them off. Then I had Jamie lay her down on the bed in her shift, with a thick layer of towels tucked round her head. I filled one of my rattlesnake syringes with the warm salt water, and with Jamie gingerly holding the lids of her eye apart, I was able to gently irrigate the eye, in hopes of perhaps preventing infection to the puncture wound. The wound itself showed as a tiny scarlet spot on the sclera, a small conjunctival bleb above it. Jamie couldn't look at it without blinking. I saw, and smiled at him.
"She'll be all right," I said. "You can go if you like."
Jamie nodded, turning to go, but Jocasta's hand shot out to stop him.
"No. Be staying, Akishla, if you will."
This last was strictly for form's sake. She had him clutched by the sleeve, hard enough to turn her fingers white.
"Aye, auntie, of course,"
he said mildly, and put his hand over hers, squeezing in reassurance. Still, she didn't let go until he had sat down beside her.
"Who else is there?"
she asked, turning her head fretfully from side to side, trying to hear the telltale sounds of breathing and movement that would inform her.
"Have the slaves gone?"
"Yes, they've gone back to help with the serving," I told her. "It's only me and Jamie left." She closed her eyes and drew a deep, shuddering breath, only then beginning to relax a little.
"Good. I must tell you a thing, nephew, and no one else must hear. Niece."
She lifted a long white hand toward me.
"Go and be seeing as we're truly alone."
I went obediently to look out into the hall. No one was visible, though there were voices coming from a room down the hall, laughter and tremendous rustlings and thumpings, as young women chattered and rearranged their hair and clothing. I pulled my head back in and closed the door, and the sounds from the rest of the house receded at once, muffled into a distant rumble.
"What is it then, Auntie?"
Jamie was still holding her hand, one big thumb gently stroking the back of it, over and over, in the soothing rhythm I'd seen him use on skittish animals. It was less effective on his aunt than on the average horse or dog, though.
"It was him. He's here."
"Who's here, Auntie?"
"I don't know."
Her eyes rolled desperately to and fro, as though in a vain attempt to see through not only darkness, but walls as well. Jamie raised his brows at me, but he could see as well as I that she wasn't raving, incoherent as she sounded. She realized what she sounded like. I could see the effort in her face as she pulled herself together.
"He's come for the gold," she said, lowering her voice. "The Frenchman's gold."
"Why?"
Jamie said cautiously. He darted a glance at me, one eyebrow raised, but I shook my head. She wasn't having hallucinations. Jocasta sighed with impatience and shook her head, then stopped abruptly with a muffled "oh" of pain, putting both hands to her head as though to keep it on her shoulders. She breathed deeply for a moment or two, her lips pressed tight together. Then she slowly lowered her hands.
"It started last night," she said,
"the pain in my eye." She'd waked in the night to find a throbbing in her eye, a dull pain that spread slowly to the side of her head.
"It's come before, Ken," she explained.
She had pushed herself up to a sitting position now, and was beginning to look a little better, though she still held the warm cloth to her eye.
"It began when I started to lose my sight. Sometimes it would be in one eye, sometimes both. But I kent what was coming."
But Jocasta Mackenzie Cameron Innes was not a woman to allow mere bodily indisposition to interfere with her plans, let alone interrupt what promised to be the most scintillating social affair in Cross Creek's history.
"I was that disgusted," she said. "And here, Miss Flora MacDonald coming."
But the arrangements had all been made. The barbecued carcasses were roasting in their pits. Hogsheads of ale and beer stood ready by the stables, and the air was full of the fragrance of hot bread and beans from the cookhouse. The slaves were well trained, and she had full faith that Ulysses would manage everything. All she must do, she'd thought, was to stay on her feet.
"I didn't want to take opium or laudanum," she explained, "or I'd fall asleep for sure. So I may do with the whisky."
She was a tall woman, and thoroughly accustomed to an intake of liquor that would have felled a modern man. By the time the MacDonalds arrived, she'd had the better part of a bottle, but the pain was getting worse.
"And then my eye began to water so fierce, everyone would have seen something was wrong, and I didn't want that. So I came into my sitting room. I'd taken care to put a wee bottle of laudanum in my work-basket, in case the whisky shouldn't be enough. Folk were swarming, thick as lice outside, trying to catch a glimpse or a word with Miss MacDonald. But the sitting-room was deserted, so far as I could tell, what with my head pounding and my eye fit to explode."
She said this last quite casually, but I saw Jamie flinch, the memory of what I'd done with the needle obviously still fresh. He swallowed and wiped his knuckles hard across his mouth. Jocasta had quickly abstracted the bottle of laudanum, swallowed a few gulps, and then sat for a moment, waiting for it to take effect.
"I dinna ken if you ever had the stuff, nephew, but it gives you an odd feeling, as though you might be starting to dissolve at the edges. Take a drop too much, and you begin to see things that aren't there, blind or not, and hear them too."
Between the effects of laudanum and liquor, and the noise of the crowd outside, she hadn't noticed footsteps. And when the voice spoke near her, she'd thought for a moment that it was a hallucination.
"So, here you are, lass," he said,
she quoted, and her face, already pale, blanched further at the memory.
"Remember me, do you?"
"I take it you did, aunt,"
Jamie asked dryly.
"I did,"
she explained, just as dryly.
"I'd heard that voice twice before. Once at the gathering where your daughter was wed, and once
more than 20 years ago, in an inn near Coyloch, in Scotland. She lowered the wet cloth from her face and put it unerringly back into the bowl of warm water. Her eyes were red and swollen, raw against the pale skin, and looking terribly vulnerable in their blindness. But she had command of herself once more.
"Aye, I did ken him," she repeated.
She had recognised the voice at once as one known, but for a moment couldn't place it. Then realisation had struck her, and she'd clutched the arm of her chair for support.
"Who are you?"
she demanded, with what force she could summon. Her heart was pounding in time to the throbbing in her head and eye, and her senses swimming in whisky and laudanum. Perhaps it was the laudanum that seemed to transform the sound of the crowd outside into the sound of a nearby sea. The noise of a slave's footsteps in the hall to the thump of the landlord's clogs on the stairs of the inn.
I was there, truly there.
Despite the sweat that still ran down her face, I saw goose flesh pebble the pale skin of her shoulders.
In the inn at Coyloch, I smelt the sea and I heard the men, Hector and Dougal. I could hear them arguing together somewhere behind me. And the man with the mask, I could see him, she said.
And a ripple went up the back of my own neck as she turned her blind eye toward me. She spoke with such conviction that for an instant it seemed she did see.
Standing at the foot of the stair, just as he'd been 25 years ago, a knife in his hand and his eyes upon me through the holes in his mask. And,
"You ken well enough who I am, lass," he'd said.
And she had seemed to see his smile, though dimly she'd known she'd only heard it in his voice. She'd never seen his face, even when she had her sight. She was sitting up, half doubled over, arms crossed over her breast as though in self-defence, and her white hair wild and tangled down her back.
"He's come back," she said,
and shook with a sudden convulsive shudder.
"He's come for the gold, and when he finds it, he will kill me."
Jamie laid a hand on her arm in an attempt to calm her.
"No one will kill you while I'm here, aunt," he said. "So this man came to you in your sitting room, and you kent him from his voice. What else did he say to you?"
She was still shivering, though not so badly. I thought it was as much a reaction to massive amounts of laudanum and whisky as from fear. She shook her head in the effort of recollection.
He said he had come to take the gold to its rightful owner, that we'd held it in trust, and while he didn't grudge me what we'd spent of it, Hector and me, it wasn't mine, had never been mine. I should tell him where it was, and he would see to the rest. And then he put his hand on me."
She ceased clutching herself and held out one arm toward Jamie.
"On my wrist. Do you see the marks there? Do you see them, nephew?"
She sounded anxious, and it occurred to me suddenly that she might doubt the existence of the visitor herself.
"Aye, auntie," Jamie said softly, touching her wrist. "There are marks."
There were. Three purplish smudges, small ovals where fingers had gripped.
"He squeezed and then twisted my wrist so hard I thought it had snapped.
Then he let go, but he didn't step back.
He stayed over me, and I could feel the heat of his breath and the stink of tobacco on my face."
I had hold of her other wrist, feeling the pulse beat there. It was strong and rapid, but every once in a while would skip a beat.
Hardly surprising.
I did wonder how often she took laudanum, and how much.
"So I reached down into my work basket, took my wee knife from its sheath, and went for his balls," she concluded.
Taken by surprise, Jamie laughed.
"Did you get him?"
"Yes, she did," I said before Jocasta could answer.
"I saw dried blood on the knife."
"Well, that will teach him to terrorize a helpless blind woman, won't it?" Jamie patted her hand.
"You did well, auntie. Did he go then?"
"He did."
The recounting of her success had steadied her a lot. She pulled her hand from my grip in order to push herself up straighter against the pillows. She pulled away the towel still draped around her neck and dropped it on the floor with a brief grimace of distaste. Seeing that she was plainly feeling better, Jamie glanced at me, then rose to his feet.
"I'll go and see is anyone limping about the place, then."
At the door, he paused, though, turning back to Jocasta.
"Auntie, you said you'd met this fellow twice before. At the inn in Coigach, when the men brought the gold ashore, and at the gathering 4 years ago."
She nodded, brushing back the damp hair from her face.
"I did. 'Twas on the last day. He came into my tent while I was alone. I kent someone was there, though he didn't speak at first, and I asked, 'Who was it?' He gave a bit of a laugh then and said, 'It's true what they said then. You're blind entirely.'"
She had stood up, facing the invisible visitor, recognizing the voice, but not quite knowing yet why.
"So you dinna ken me, Mrs. Cameron. I was a friend to your husband, though it's been a good many years since last we met. On the coast of Scotland, on a moonlicht nicht."
She licked dry lips at the memory. "So then it came to me all on the sudden, and I said, 'Blind I may be, but I ken you well, sir. What do you want?' But he was gone, and the next instant I heard Phaedra and Ulysses talking as they came toward the tent. He'd seen them and fled away. I asked them, but they'd been taken up with their arguing and hadn't seen him leave. I kept someone by me all the time then until we left, and he didn't come near me again. Until now."
Jamie frowned and rubbed a knuckle slowly down the long, straight bridge of his nose.
"Why did you not tell me then?"
A trace of humour touched her ravaged face, and she wrapped her fingers round her injured wrist.
"I thought I was imagining things."
Phaedra had found the bottle of laudanum where Jocasta had dropped it, under her chair in the sitting room. Likewise, a trail of tiny blood spots that I had missed in my hurry. These disappeared before reaching the door, though. Whatever wound Jocasta had inflicted on the intruder had been minor. Duncan, summoned discreetly, had hurried in to comfort Jocasta, only to be sent directly out again, with instructions to see to the guests. Neither injury nor illness was going to mar such an occasion. Ulysses met with a slightly more cordial reception. In fact, Jocasta sent for him. Peering into her room to check on her, I found him sitting by the bed, holding his mistress's hand, with such an expression of gentleness on his usually impassive face that I was quite moved by it, and stepped quietly back into the hall not to disturb them. He saw me, though, and nodded. They were talking in low voices, his head in its stiff white wig bending toward hers. He seemed to be arguing with her in a most respectful fashion. She shook her head and gave a small cry of pain. His hand tightened on hers, and I saw that he had taken off his white gloves. Her hand lay long and frail, pallid in his powerful, dark grasp. She breathed deeply, steadying herself. Then she said something definite, squeezed his hand, and lay back. He rose and stood for a moment beside the bed, looking down at her. Then he drew himself up, and taking his gloves from his pocket, came out into the hall.
"If you will fetch your husband, Mrs. Fraser," he said, low-voiced, "my mistress wishes me to tell him something."
The party was still in full swing, but had shifted to a lower, digestive sort of gear. People greeted Jamie or me as we followed Ulysses into the house, but no one stopped us. He led us downstairs to his butler's pantry, a tiny room that lay off the winter kitchen, its shelves crammed with silver ornaments, bottles of polish, vinegar, blacking and bluing, a hussif with needles, pins and threads, small tools for mending, and what looked like a substantial private stock of brandy, whiskey and assorted cordials. He removed these from their shelf, and reaching back into the empty space where they had stood, pressed upon the wood of the wall with both white-gloved hands. Something clicked, and a small panel slid aside with a soft, rasping sound. He stood aside, silently inviting Jamie to look. Jamie raised one eyebrow and leaned forward, peering into the recess.
It was dark and shadowy in the butler's pantry, with only a dim light filtering in from the high basement windows that ran around the top of the kitchen walls.
"It's empty," he said.
"Yes, sir. It should not be."
Ulysses' voice was low and respectful, but firm.
"What was there?"
I asked, glancing out of the pantry to be sure we were not overheard. The kitchen looked as though a bomb had gone off in it, but only a scullion was there, a half-witted boy who was washing pots, singing softly to himself.
"Part of an ingot of gold,"
Ulysses replied softly. The French gold Hector Cameron had brought away from Scotland, £10,000 in bullion, cast in ingots, and marked with the royal fleur-de-lis, was the foundation of River Run's wealth. But it would not do, of course, for that fact to be known. First Hector, and then, after Hector's death, Ulysses, had taken one of the gold bars and scraped bits of the soft yellow metal into a small anonymous heap. This could then be taken to the river warehouses, or, for additional safety, sometimes as far as the coastal towns of Edenton, Wilmington, or New Bern, and there, carefully changed, in small amounts that would cause no comment, into cash or warehouse certificates, which could safely be used anywhere.
"There was about half of the ingot left," Ulysses said, nodding toward the cavity in the wall. "I found it gone a few months ago. Since then, of course, I have contrived a new hiding place."
Jamie looked into the empty cavity, then turned to Ulysses.
"The rest? Safe enough, last time I checked, sir."
The bulk of the gold was concealed inside Hector Cameron's mausoleum, hidden in a coffin, and guarded, presumably, by his spirit. One or two of the slaves, besides Ulysses, might know about it, but the very lively fear of ghosts was enough to keep everyone away. I remembered the line of salt spread on the ground in front of the mausoleum, and shivered a little, in spite of the stifling heat in the basement.
"I could not, of course, make shift to look today," the butler added. "No, of course not. Duncan knows."
Jamie nodded toward the recess, and Ulysses nodded.
"The thief might have been anyone. So many people come to this house."
The butler's massive shoulders moved in a small shrug.
"But now that this man from the sea has come again, it puts a different face upon the matter, does it not, sir?"
"Aye, it does."
Jamie contemplated the matter for a moment, tapping two fingers softly against his leg.
"Well, then, you'll need to stay for a bit, Sassenach, will you not, to look after my aunt's eye?"
I nodded. Provided no infection resulted from my crude intervention, there was little or nothing I could do for the eye itself. But it should be watched, kept clean and irrigated, until I could be sure it was healed.
"We'll stay then for a bit," he said, turning to Ulysses. "I'll send the bugs back to the ridge to mind things and see to the haying. We'll stay and watch."
The house was full of guests, but I slept in Jocasta's dressing room so that I might keep an eye on her. The easing of pressure in her eye had relieved the excruciating pain, and she had fallen soundly asleep, her vital signs reassuring enough that I felt I could sleep too. Knowing I had a patient, though, I slept lightly, waking at intervals to tiptoe into her room. Duncan was sleeping on a pallet at the foot of her bed, dead to the world from the exhaustions of the day. I could hear his heavy breathing as I lit a taper from the hearth and came to stand by the bed. Jocasta was still soundly asleep, lying on her back, arms crossed gracefully over the coverlet, and her head thrown back, sternly long-nosed and aristocratic as the tomb figures in the chapel of Saint-Denis. All she wanted was a crown, and a small dog of some kind crouched at her feet. I smiled at the thought, thinking as I did, how odd it was. Jamie slept in exactly that fashion, lying flat on his back, hands crossed, straight as an arrow. Brianna didn't. She was a wild sleeper and had been from a child. Like me. The thought gave me a small unexpected feeling of pleasure. I knew I had given her some parts of me, of course, but she resembled Jamie so strongly it was always something of a surprise to notice one.
I blew out the taper, but didn't at once return to bed. I had taken Fedra's cot in the dressing room, but it was a hot, airless little space. The hot day and the consumption of alcohol had left me cotton-mouthed with a vague headache. I picked up the carafe from Jocasta's bedside, but it was empty. No need to relight the taper. One of the sconces in the hallway was still burning, and a dim glow outlined the door. I pushed it open quietly and looked out. The corridor was lined with bodies, servants sleeping by the doors of the bedrooms, and the air throbbed gently with the snoring and heavy breathing of a great many people sunk in slumber of varying degrees. At the end of the corridor, though, one pale figure stood upright, looking out through the tall casement window toward the river. She must have heard me, but didn't turn around. I came to stand beside her, looking out. Fedre was undressed to her shift, her hair free of its cloth, and falling in a soft, thick mass around her shoulders. Rare for a slave to have such hair, I thought. Most women kept their hair very short under turban or headcloth, lacking both time and tools for dressing it. But Fedre was a body servant. She would have some leisure, and a comb, at least. "Would you like your bed back?" I asked, low-voiced. "I'll be up for a while, and can sleep on the divan." She glanced at me and shook her head. "Oh, no, ma'am," she said softly. "Thank ye kindly. I ain't sleepy." She saw the carafe I carried and reached for it. "I fetch you some water, ma'am." "No, no, I'll do it. I'd like the air." Still, I stood beside her, looking out. It was a beautiful night, thick with stars that hung low and bright over the river, a faint silver thread that wound its way through the dark. There was a moon, a slender sickle, riding low on its way below the curve of the earth, and one or two small campfires burned in the trees beside the river. The window was open, and bugs were swarming in. A small cloud of them danced around the candle in the sconce behind us, and tiny winged things brushed my face and arms. Crickets sang, so many of them that their song was a high, constant sound, like a bow drawn over violin strings. Fedre moved to shut it. To sleep with a window open was considered most unhealthy, and likely was, given the various mosquito-borne diseases in this swampish atmosphere. "I thought I heard something, out there," she said, nodding toward the dark below. "Oh?" "Probably my husband," I said. "Or Ulysses." "Ulysses?" she said, looking startled. Jamie, Ian, and Ulysses had organized a system of patrol, and were doubtless out somewhere in the night, gliding round the house, and keeping an eye on Hector's mausoleum, just in case. Knowing nothing of the disappearing gold, nor Jocasta's mysterious visitor, though, Fedre wouldn't be aware of the increased vigilance, save in the indirect way in which slaves always knew things. The instinct that had doubtless roused her to look out the window. "They're just keeping an eye out," I said, as reassuringly as I could. "With so many people here, you know." The MacDonalds had gone to Farquhar Campbell's plantation to spend the night, and a goodly number of guests had gone with them, but there were still a lot of people on the premises. She nodded, but looked troubled. "It just feels like something ain't right," she said. "Don't know what 'tis." "Your mistress's eye," I began. But she shook her head. "No, no. I don't know. But there's something in the air. I be feeling it. Not just tonight. I don't mean something going on. Something coming." She looked at me, helpless to express what she meant, but her mood communicated itself to me. "It might be, in part, simply the heightened emotions of the oncoming conflict. One could, in fact, feel that in the air. But there might be something else, too. Something subterranean, barely sensed, but there. Like the dim form of a sea serpent, glimpsed for only a moment, then gone. And so put down to legend." "My granny, she taken from Africa," Fedra said softly, staring out at the night. "She talked to the bones. Say they tell her when bad things coming." "Really?" In such an atmosphere, quiet save the night sounds, so many souls adrift around us,
There seemed nothing unreal about such a statement.
Did she teach you to...
talk to bones? She shook her head, but the corner of her mouth tucked in, a small secret expression, and I thought she might know more about it than she was willing to say. One unwelcome thought had occurred to me. I didn't see how Stephen Bonnet could be connected to present events. Surely he wasn't the man who had spoken to Jocasta out of her past, and just as surely stealthy theft wasn't his style. But he did have some reason to believe there might be gold somewhere at River Run, and from what Roger had told us of Fedra's encounter with the big Irishman in Cross Creek... "The Irishman you met when you were out with Jemmy," I said, changing my grip on the slick surface of the carafe. "Have you ever seen him again?" She looked surprised at that. Clearly, Bonnet was the farthest thing from her mind.
"No, ma'am," she said. "Ain't seen him again, ever."
She thought for a moment, big eyes hooded. She was the colour of strong coffee with a dash of cream. And her hair. There had been a white man in her family tree at some time, I thought. "No, ma'am," she repeated softly, and turned her troubled gaze back to the quiet night and the sinking moon. "All I know, something ain't right." Out by the stables, a rooster began to crow, the sound out of place and eerie in the dark. Chapter 55. Wendigo. August the 20th, 1774. The light in the morning room was perfect. "We began with this room," Jocasta had told her great-niece, raising her face to the sun that poured through the open double doors to the terrace, lids closed over her blind eyes. "I wanted a room to paint in, and chose this spot, where the light would come in, bright as crystal in the morning, like still water in the afternoon. And then we built the house around it." The old woman's hands, still long-fingered and strong, touched the easel, the pigment pots, the brushes, with affectionate regret, as she might caress the statue of a long-dead lover, a passion recalled, but accepted as forever gone. And Brianna, sketching block and pencil in hand, had drawn as quickly as covertly as she could, to catch that fleeting expression of grief outlived. That sketch lay with the others in the bottom of her box, against the day when she might try it in a more finished form. Try to catch that merciless light and the deep carved lines of her aunt's face, strong bones stark in the sun she couldn't see. For now, though, the painting at hand was a matter of business rather than love or art. Nothing suspicious had happened since Flora MacDonald's barbecue, but her parents meant to stay for a little longer just in case. With Roger still in Charlotte, he had written to her. The letter was secreted in the bottom of her box, with the private sketches. There was no reason why she shouldn't stay, too. Hearing of her continued presence, two or three of Jocasta's acquaintances, wealthy planters, had commissioned portraits of themselves or their families, a welcome source of income.
"I will never understand how you do that," Ian said, shaking his head at the canvas on her easel. "That's wonderful."
In all honesty, she didn't understand how she did it either. It didn't seem necessary. She'd said as much in answer to similar compliments before, though, and realized that such an answer generally struck the hearer either as false modesty or as condescension. She smiled at him instead, letting the glow of pleasure she felt show in her face. "When I was little, my father would take me walking on the common, and we'd see an old man there often painting with an easel. I used to make Daddy stop so I could watch, and he and the old man would chat. I mostly just stared, but once I got up the nerve to ask him how he did that, and he looked down at me and smiled and said, 'The only trick, sweetie, is to see what you're looking at.'"
Ian looked from her to the picture, then back, as though comparing the portrait with the hand that had made it.
"Your father?" he said, interested.
He lowered his voice, glancing toward the door into the hallway. There were voices, but not close.
"You dinna mean Uncle Jimmy?"
"No."
She felt the familiar small ache at the thought of her first father, but put it aside. She didn't mind telling Ian about him, but not here, with slaves all over the place, and a constant flow of visitors who might pop in at any moment.
Look.
She glanced over her shoulder to be sure no one was near, but the slaves were talking loudly in the foyer, arguing over a misplaced boot scraper. She lifted the cover of the small compartment that held spare brushes and reached under the strip of felt that lined it.
What do you think?
She held the pair of miniatures out for his inspection, one on either palm. The look of expectation on his face changed to outright fascination, and he reached slowly for one of the tiny paintings.
"I'll be damned," he said.
It was the one of her mother, her hair long and curling loose on bare shoulders, the small firm chin raised with an authority that belied the generous curve of the